our discussion.
Okay.
Is this a CNN or is it a friendly satellite? Or yes, they're you get expelled. We actually are at the point in the Bible which talks about the founding of the old Babylonian Empire, which is modern day Iraq. This part of the Bible tells us about the very earliest history of Babylonia, the ancient civilization. There's quite a bit we know about that. Then we encounter the later revival of the Babylonian Empire in the book of Daniel, if you remember. Very dramatic period in the later history of Babylon when Nebuchadnezzar came into power and Daniel was there and throughout his whole lifetime. And that's a fascinating little story all in itself, Israel's captivity in Babylon. There is a very great deal in the Bible about the long-term history of Iraq. That's almost, we could do a session on that sometime separately, but quite a few prophecies talk about the final, ultimate destruction of Babylon eventually. The images we have in of the origin of Satan are tied in with the king of Babylon, for instance. Apparently it's a stronghold of evil and darkness down through all of history, and eventually gets totally wiped out. Probably not right now, but so that's why the war is particularly interesting right now, to see what God's actually doing in the Middle East. And it's interesting how this war, it's interesting to me how it polarizes the whole world, how people are all up in arms in peace movements, and other people are vigorous supporters of the war, and it's really quite a time in world history. Chapters 10 and 11 of Genesis go together, kind of. And matter of fact, the chapter break is at chapter 11, verse 10. We have another one of those signatures at verse 10. This is the genealogy of Shem. It closes this section. And then, so presumably everything after chapter 11, verse 10 is written by somebody later than Shem, one of his sons, probably, or something like that. This is the Toledot model of original source documents for the book of Genesis that all got down to Moses so he could put them all together. Last week we talked about the descendants of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. I gave you a piece of paper today that I forgot to make last week on the sons of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and a very brief summary of the major names and also some of the modern names that we know are associated with those very ancient names. That chart over on the left, which you might want to look at, comes from Southwest Radio Church many, many years ago, and it is a little chart of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and where they went geographically, or as far as we have any idea. I haven't seen any more recent editions of that chart. Somebody wants to draw one, we could probably sell a dozen or so on the internet or be popular. I also made you, just for my own thinking and fun, I made you two other little charts just because it's so easy to do. On my webpage, I have a couple of articles that are very thorough about world population growth down through history. And there's a simple little formula to calculate world population growth based on the assumed number of children per family and assumed length of a generation. And you can easily do a whole range of calculations to show what would be reasonable population growth. And I mentioned to you that on the basis of reasonable population growth rates, the population before the flood could well have been many billions of people. It's not a stretch of credulity at all to perfectly reasonable based on living 900 years in fairly modest family sizes. In fact, one of the problems before the flood is if you get more than about 5 or 6 children per family, you get impossibly high values of the population by the time of Noah. Similarly, after the flood, we have a pretty good idea about population growth. Most every secular statistician or population expert will agree that around the time of the Roman Empire, around the time of Jesus, the world population was somewhere around 200 million, 300 million people. This seems to be an educated guess. Nobody seems to be willing to think either much lower than 200 million or much greater than maybe 400 million or something like that. So that's a ballpark number. So from the time of Christ until the present, we have a pretty good idea what the world population is. And that, a long time ago, I gave you a chart showing how it climbing right out of all possible boundaries right now at the present time. World population growth rates are a pretty strong evidence against evolution, if you stop and look about it. Because if you put one man and one woman on the world a million years ago, which is kind of evolutionary model, and you let them have children at a reasonable rate, then you'd have the whole universe full of dead bodies by now. That's the rate at which human populations grow. In other words, it takes a few thousand years to totally fill the earth with people. Now, this is not absolute. If every couple has two children, 2.0 children, then world population growth is zero. You don't get, the population stays constant. The world population in all of known history has never been 2.0 children per family. It's always been 2.2, 2.5, 3.0 on the average, sort of. And as we see here in Genesis 11, we can see very clearly the population growth in this early time period is at least 5 children per family. We'll see that a little bit later on today. Now, on the basis of, if you take the assumption that the population in the time of Jesus was 200 million then, and I'm saying the flood's back around 3500, 3600 BC, then I made this little chart here of hypothetically what the world population might have been in the time period from the flood down to Jesus. And that's interesting. For example, the Tower of Babel incident would occur probably in about the fourth generation, say, after the flood. After the flood, we've got 8 people. And those people, the sons of Noah, all begin to have sons, and they begin to have children. So by the time of the Tower of Babel, what's the world population? Well, the world population could have been as few as a couple of thousand, could have been maybe 10,000. That's not very many total world population, is it? You think about the Tower of Babel from what you remember from Sunday school when you were a little kid, you probably think of millions of people gathering around this monstrously big tower and this scattering of nations all over the globe. Well, the total number could not have been very large, a few thousand people. That's probably the idea. Last week we talked about about Nimrod briefly. He's mentioned in chapter 10. He comes up again today as the man responsible for the building of Babylon and the construction of this large tower. The world population continues to climb, and a lot of people would make the intelligent guess that by the time of Abraham we have 1 or 2 million people on the whole earth. That's still not very many people scattered over the whole earth. Now this is still a long ways away from the so-called evolutionary growth curve, which would put a very small number of people on the earth for a million years, all the way down to a few thousand BC, at which point the population starts to grow. That doesn't fit anything that we know about human history or human civilization. So this is this little curve, population Noah to Jesus, is just a very rough cut. This little chart here is post-flood patriarchs. And I put on there, those little vertical lines are the lifespans of the individual patriarchs. By patriarch, I mean somebody in the line of Shem. The line of Shem is going to eventually lead to the Messiah. So there's Noah over on the far left and his lifespan, and the dotted line is about where the flood is, and then Shem, and then you'll notice that the lifespans are shrinking after the flood, and I took this all the way down to Isaac and Jacob over here on the right. This is subject to a good deal. You can stretch this if you want to, but I think this sort of for purposes of study. And then on the right, I suggested the time for the Tower of Babel at maybe 3300 BC or something like that, and the extinction of dinosaurs, and that perhaps in the days of Peleg, perhaps by a large comet or a meteor impact, and then an ice age, and the recovery from the ice age, and Job being early, Job being probably before Abraham or right around the time of Abraham, because he lived so long. He lived a long time. And so this takes you down. Now, this chart, population Noah to Jesus, has 60 generations on it. That's about right. About 60 generations from Adam to Jesus. That's also, you'll see that's reflected on the chart over there. So the Bible's actually got a great deal of detailed information on the family tree of Adam all the way down to Jesus, particularly focusing on the line of Shem. Okay? So those are just for your thoughts and your imagination. I put some 3x5 cards out here for the shy persons in the class, if there are any shy persons. And you want to write some questions, and and turn them in, and then when I answer them, I won't embarrass anybody, except myself probably. Because I think the discussion time sometimes is the best part of our whole class. So let's look at chapter 11 a little bit. First of all, chapter, maybe one more thing about chapter 10. Chapter 10, remember, began with a short lineage for Japheth. And it's short. And then it began with a somewhat longer but still quite short list of the descendants of Ham. And then we get a long list for Shem. And the long list for Shem is going to continue today. Well, that's logical if Shem was writing this all down. Shem would have known about his own branch of the family, and he would have known less about Ham, but quite a bit. And then Japheth moves off to Europe, and he kind of loses track of that branch of the family until he got the internet in and got communication. So that's why that's cut off a little bit. I mentioned Bill Cooper's book, After the Flood. He lives in the UK, and he's carried the history of the line of Japheth way down on in through Anglo-Saxon England, and on a very fascinating book. And Arthur Custance, a Canadian scholar, carried these genealogies a bit further. So I think that in time you can get a real continuity of the history of mankind as it really was. Chapter 11. Really an extension goes right on from chapter 10. Now the whole earth had one language and one speech. The whole earth, that would mean all of mankind, had one language and one vocabulary, what it really means. And that leads to the speculation of what was the original language. There are families of languages. Most of us here come from the Indo-European branch of the families of languages. The Hamitic languages are more numerous. There are several Semitic languages. I think, did I give you a sheet of paper? I intended to. On these families. I think last time I heard there were about 6,500 languages that are actively used in the world today. Something like that. A lot of languages. Now, and I also mentioned that the rabbis love to suggest that Hebrew or something, that Proto-Hebrew or Proto-Semitic language was the original root language. And the rabbis love that, to talk about that. And one of my favorite writers in this area, in this whole subject, is a nice Jewish gentleman in New York by the name of Isaac Moseson, very kindly, scholarly gentleman, who gives you an English dictionary with the original Hebrew word. And his claim is that even many of our very common American English words can be tracked back to original Hebrew roots. This is a book that's in print and it's still worth getting, and he's a nice gentleman. He gets on the internet sometimes. You get an email from him. I've had several emails from him. He's a nice guy, and it's generally I don't think anybody disputes his ideas very strong and strenuously. Of course, when you have a bunch of Jews talking about things, you get two Jews as three opinions, and you're going to get a whole bunch of contradictory ideas on things. But the original roots of language is a whole interesting subject. So we're told very clearly here that there was a time in human history when everybody spoke a common language and that we had a common vocabulary, and so there was lots of communication. That, of course, we remember that it was probably God that taught Adam how to speak. That speech and probably writing is early. And that's contrary to the standard secular evolutionary view that man had, you know, evolved and had to learn how to grunt and groan and moan and communicate with signs, and finally the language comes late. Well, the Bible doesn't say that. The Bible suggests that language was very early, that God taught Adam how to speak. Adam was given the job of naming the animals very early on. He had to name the animals. He had to identify them, study them, analyze them, put them in classes and categories, and then put a name on them, a name that conveyed something about the meaning of things. So I expect there's a great body of knowledge that was handed to Adam, and Adam shared it with Eve, and they had long dinner conversations and prayer times and discussions. And I don't know if they had laptop computers, but if they did, I'm sure they would have accumulated a large vocabulary from their experiences. And they would have passed on, certainly in verbal form, they would have passed on a great deal of knowledge to their children. It would have been an F with one bite out of it, with one missing bite. Yeah. That's right. that apple's that choice of the apostles, as you know. Get the bite on the side. So it's kind of fun, I think, if you think back about family gatherings when people live 900 years and you get together and talk and share. And not only is there this investigation of nature and the exploration of the world going on, but there's this close communication with God. And there's a lot of divine revelation and divine knowledge being imparted to Adam. So Adam knows a great deal about God. He's a wise man and he's well-educated and has a great deal to share. And this information about origins is passed on down to the next generation. Shem, Ham, and Japheth would have known a great deal about the history of the life before the flood. If they ever find Noah's Ark, it'd be fun to see if there's a library there and if they had any books, because we have almost no knowledge about life before in the period before the flood of Noah. But I believe there certainly was a great body of knowledge, information, language, vocabulary, and all this one common language. Now, we come to verse 2. It came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they would be Shem, Ham, and Japheth and their families. I don't know whether it's really east or whether it's southeast. If the ark landed up in eastern Turkey, in the mountains that are today called the mountains of Ararat, if that's where they came from, and generally we think they did, then they moved down into the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, which is in the news right now. And they moved down into that fertile plain watered by these two big rivers. If you've seen that, watch CNN, you know that most of the area to the west is the big desert and that it's very fertile around the Tigris-Euphrates rivers to this very day. And it's a rich farmland. And so this is the so-called Fertile Crescent area where human civilization has its start. So it doesn't tell us how long after the flood, how many people are migrating, how many people go down there, probably on foot or maybe with animals and beasts. And they certainly don't have a lot of possessions accumulated by this. I mean, they've got their animals and they've got tents. And they move on down out of maybe Turkey into the plain of Shinar. That's the plain around Babylon. Then they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. Now, this is not all of them. It's not Shem, Ham, and Japheth and all the whole family getting together and saying, let's build ourselves nice buildings. It's Ham, and it's particularly it's Ham's son, Nimrod, whom we met in chapter 10. The technicians, the pyramid builders, the artisans, craftsmen, inventors go down there, and there's probably no handy forests around, but there's plenty of clay, and there's asphalt oil pits. And with their ingenuity, they figure they can build nice buildings and nice towers using mud bricks and gluing them with asphalt. Nimrod, really, especially. Shem, Ham, and Japheth are living pretty close to each other, but the real motivation to build a city is Nimrod, who's the mighty hunter that we met in chapter 10. The mighty hunter who rebels against the Lord, who begins to lead an organized coalition in rebellion against the rule of Jehovah over human life, begins to go out and build cities all over the whole area. Remember, the first city before the flood was built by Cain, the condemned murderer. The first city after the flood is built by Nimrod, who revolts against God. We'll come back to Nimrod and what he did there. We come back to that original religious system that he started there. So we have this city, probably ancient Babylon, which is, what, 60 miles south of Baghdad? Is it? Never been there yet. Maybe we can all go next year. It's quiet over there. I'd like to. They said to themselves, remember, we're starting out with all believers. We're starting out with Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and their wives are pretty strong believers because they've seen the whole flood, and they're starting to raise their kids in the knowledge of the Lord and sending them to Sunday school and off to seminary and things. So they're doing all they can to get their kids to stay close to the Lord. And how long do you suppose it is before a good number of the children begin to go off and do their own thing and buy into Nimrod's line? Nimrod's line would be, come on, let's build a great civilization for ourselves. We really don't need God. Let's go do it for ourselves and we'll get this. Well, pretty soon you have the believers being a small minority in the culture. Like today, you have the people that are faithful to Jehovah numbering fewer and fewer, and you have the secular majority springing up, and it's this group of people that goes off to build the city of Babylon. Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower, a ziggurat, whose top is in the heavens. I think the foundation of this tower has been found by archaeologists at, I think it's probably pretty well known, but we know about the existence of these spiral towers in that part of the world over there, built from very earliest times. Nebuchadnezzar's palace is in Babylon. That was restored. Saddam Hussein restored that in the last recent years because he thought himself was the new Nebuchadnezzar. And he likes to think of himself also in the great tradition of Nimrod. So his roots over there go way deep. So we're going to build a big tower and we'll make a name for ourselves. Doesn't sound exactly like being a humble, low-profile servant of Jehovah. It's let us make a great civilization in our own honor and our own memory. Lest we be scattered over the whole face of the earth, because we don't want to be spread too thin. We want to come together, and that's exactly contrary to what God had told them to do, both at the time of Adam and also to Noah. It was to scatter and fill the earth. And they're doing exactly the opposite. They're refusing to scatter. They want to build a great society. This tower, we know enough about it that it's a tower to reach up to heaven, and on the top part of the tower is a temple, where the priests can go and call down the powers of heaven and commune with the gods. And it's that man reaching up to find God. The pyramids of Egypt are probably a generation later, and they probably have much the same idea of man becoming his own God, man attaining his own greatness through his own efforts. Rebellion against God. Now, you'd think, well, this is great. We're going to have one world government. We're going to have world unity. We can put in a good government. And obviously, there's a great advantage to living in a city. Close communication and grocery stores right next door and 7-Elevens right there. And everything's handy. And I mentioned earlier that this is one of the themes that runs through the whole Bible, is the theme of the two cities, the city of God and the city of man. The whole history of mankind is about great cities and great world empires and great kingdoms and the centralization of power and authority. And as much as it's attractive to live in a city, it's also something that we don't do very well. We fail pretty miserably at cities living. Cities become centers of crime and pollution, and all sorts of things go on in cities that don't take place in small farm villages. And yet, in the end, we're all going to end up in the city of God. We're going to end up in the New Jerusalem, which is this beautiful city. It's picturing then a godly community, the real thing. So the city of man and the city of God, even Augustine talked about these, are two themes. Just like the picture of the woman in the Bible, that one of the women in the Bible is a great prostitute, and the other woman in the Bible is a beautiful bride. And these are opposites that show the same human tendencies in man. All right, now God comes down. God sees this city being built, catches it on his morning satellite report, briefing from the CIA, and it comes to the Lord's attention. Obviously, I'm joking, because God knows perfectly well everything that's going on before it ever happens. He knew this is all going to take place. But the language here is the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. Now that phrase, the Lord came down, puts a little emphasis on it. It means this was more than a passing interest of the Lord. Same language at the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. The Lord came down to see if the evil in Sodom and Gomorrah was as bad as had been reported to him. Well, God knew perfectly well how evil Sodom and Gomorrah were. He didn't have to come down and see for himself. The language, God came down to look for himself, is kind of like God's personal intervention, which may mean that we've got a rather violent, catastrophic intervention of God in history at this point in time. There's nothing in here that suggests a geological catastrophe. I have suggested, but I have no real proof, that the crust of the earth is probably still unstable, that we're getting volcanism, that we've got an ice age, that we've got a lot of climate changes going on, and Barry Sutterfield would like to punctuate these and say there was a particular episode of disaster, the Tower of Babel, I don't know. And then another, something going on geologically a little later in the days of Peleg when maybe the continent split up. Well, those are all, that's all speculative. What we know here is that God is going to interfere with human plans to unite the world under one world government. It's interesting now that long later, at near the end of history, we have this same kind of tendency to pull the world together under one world government. We have more or less a common world language again. At least English is a usable language most everywhere. You go to the UN and you put on headphones and you can get your native language interpreted for you. So it's now possible for human beings to communicate again, which wasn't as efficient as it in the old days as it is now. And now you find more and more secular world leaders saying we've got to have one world government. We've got to curb the world population growth, which is out of hand, and worry about famines and food distribution, and we need a universal military force. And you can see that how logical that is from a secular standpoint. If you don't believe that God's in charge of human affairs, and you've got the possibility of anarchy all over the place, then conscientious non-Christian world leaders are going to want to move towards centralization of power again. So we're kind of moving there at the end of history. But at this point in history, this is premature. And God comes down to the Tower of Babel, to this great city, and interrupts it. The Lord said, indeed, the people are one. There is a unity then, unity of purpose, plan, and intention that's not in harmony with God's plan. That's an organized, unified, secular system with a good deal of unity. The people are all one, and they have one language, and this is what they will begin to do. Nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Then with this kind of unity and this sort of unification of resources and central government, there's no limit to the amount of what they can do with their great civilization. How many great civilizations have come and gone down through history? And here's the first one in which men say to themselves, we can do just anything we want, particularly if we put all our heads and minds and resources together and think tanks and unite all our and work together on a big team. And that's going to be contrary to God's plan and program. So God says, come, let us go down and confuse their languages. We've got that plural us in there, Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Now, once again, this suggests that the intervention of God's going to be rather violent. It's going to be some, he's not going to just sign a little order and say, scatter. He's coming down and personally doing something. And what God decides to do is to confuse their languages that they may not understand one another's speech. So all of a sudden they're busy building the tower and building this city and having their council meetings, and suddenly they break up into various languages and one group can't speak to another group. Language families, groups. So I expect that, I'm guessing, but I expect that the people of Shem found that they were still able to communicate reasonably well with all their relatives, and I expect that the people of Japheth, in a way, could understand one another, or at least didn't take them too long to figure out the similarities between their languages. And the people of Ham found that there was considerable confusion, and the whole thing turns into chaos. Now, that sort of forces people to begin to go live outside of Babylon, begins to go start a little colony over here of people that speak your own language. That accomplishes this scattering. It begins to accomplish this scattering and the moving apart. And as you move apart, you're going to have to get resources for caring for your animals and a suitable land that you can grow crops and resources to build housing. So mankind begins to be scattered. And now if you want to talk to somebody who speaks another language, you've got to get all the diplomats in the world involved and language translators. And you know how hard that is. Wycliffe, early Wycliffe. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building the city. Stopped the city building. And didn't go any further. Therefore, the name is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. Babel is a combination of two words. Bab, gate, El, God, gate of God. One of the associations with Babel is that it is the gateway to God. That would be the gateway to God in terms of this tower and reaching up to God. It would be the religious doorway. The one world religion idea would be what this is all about, Babylon. There's a Hebrew word that's very close to Babel, and it's the word Balal, B-A-L-A-L. Balal means confusion. Very close word. Confusion. The confusion of languages is associated with Babel. Okay? Now we're going to, maybe we'll look a little bit at Babylon right now. The rest of the chapter is going to take us back on to the family of Shem again, and it's going to run us all the way down to Abraham. But let's look a little bit at the Babylonian mystery religion, which we know a lot about, or a little about. Way back, I think in the 1800s sometime, and I can't find my copy, a man named Alexander Hislop wrote a book called Two Babylons. Maybe you've seen it. Ancient. Still in print. Still. And books like that. Here's one by Ralph Woodrow. Babylon. Mystery Babylon. And Hislop's come under a lot of criticism because his book is old. It's been around a long time. He's particularly severe in criticizing the Roman Catholic Church, among other things. And his book isn't full of a lot of references of independent resources that you could go and look at. But I think we could agree on the general thing. The general features of the Babylonian mystery religion seem to be pretty much built around the man Nimrod, whose initials NMR. NMR, Ray points this out, are closely related to Marduk, M-R-D. Marduk is the chief god of ancient Babylon, Marduk. And Marduk then would be the central god-man in a way. He's the head honcho of this religion, and he has a priesthood. The wife of Nimrod was a woman named Semiramis. Go to Cairo, you can stay in this Semiramis Hotel if you want to. It's still there. It's a name that's still around. Semiramis, there's several accounts of this. Semiramis is supposed to have had a virgin-born son. She's supposed to have given birth to a boy named Thomas, some variant on that, which puts into religion the element of the Madonna and child, the mother and child goddess idea. Well, then, of course, it's pretty easy to extrapolate that into the religions of the world where there's special reverence to a goddess, mother, and maybe a son. Aphrodite, Venus, and Adonis, and Isis and Osiris, and the Virgin Mary, and Jesus, and in India, and the religions of the world, there you can find this particular adoration of a virgin and child, miraculous birth. The religion of ancient Babylon is said to have had features very much like those you would find in the Roman Catholic Church today. Particularly the Mass, for instance. The Mass is a reoffering of Jesus week after week in a symbolic way that's a long ways away from the Lord's table. Some of the priestly garments are described. The origin of Easter and Christmas is attributed to the Babylonian mystery religion. There's a lot of controversy about the details, but in general, it would appear that this mystery religion of Babylon, a mystery religion is a religion where you join and then the real secrets are revealed to you after you become a member. Mystery religions were very common in the ancient world. We still have them today. The Rosicrucians in San Jose are a mystery religion. Join, pay your dues, and then we'll initiate you into the lost secrets of mankind, which is a kind of what Satan said to Eve in the beginning. You know, I have some secret knowledge to give to you, and God doesn't want you to know about it, so come and follow me. The Babylonian mystery religion then seems to be the primitive, primeval, one-world religion that existed before the Tower of Babel. It seems to be a religion. Ray pointed out long, long years ago that the Babylonian mystery religion appears to have branched off into three different directions. One of the splits in the Babylonian mystery religion was off in the direction of India, where some of these elements from this religion get incorporated into Hinduism and into the pantheistic religions of the Far East. And you can find the roots there. The second branch of the old Babylonian mystery religion would have gone off probably into Egypt. Egyptian mystery religion, we know quite a little bit about that from the script of the Book of the Dead and some of the pyramids, the pyramid texts. tell about the afterlife and the gods and the goddesses and all of the mythology of Egypt. The third branch of the Roman Empire is supposed to have gone off to Pergamum, and from there into the Etruscan mystery religions, and from there into Europe, and some would say from there into the medieval Catholic Church, where we get a lot of the features of the papacy and the traditions of the Roman Catholic Church embedded, where you begin to get these widespreading of pagan influence. Now, that's controversial. That's debatable. I think you'd want to go look at Hyslop, and you can find Hyslop's all on the internet. His whole book's on there. If you go and just type in Two Babylons, you can read the whole thing. And I think that you'll see, well, yes, some of it makes sense. Some of it probably is very unfair and biased. And as Protestants, we'd love to bash people that don't worship exactly the way we do. And we don't have any traditions and idols and things in our lives. Of course, we're all pure. So I think the whole point is that it appears to have been the wellspring of false religion in Babylon. This appears to be like a fountainhead of evil that's going to spread pollution through the whole human race, and it's going to permeate all branches of mankind. And it's going to spread itself, diffuse itself through the whole world. Now, when you get to the book of Revelation, in chapter 17 and 18, we have something called Mystery Babylon the Great, Mother of Harlots and Earth's Abominations. Now, in the New Testament, the word mystery means a body of truth that was not known previously but has now been revealed. Mystery Babylon the Great is a body of information about false religion that John the Apostle is making known in chapter 17 and 18. Chapter 17 and 18 in Revelation talk about one world religion at the end of the age. One corrupt world religion. Who is this woman, Mystery Babylon the Great, is held responsible for all the evil done on down through the history of the world, and is held responsible particularly for the blood of all the followers of God that have ever been shed. In other words, false religion is indicted in Revelation chapter 17 in the strongest and harshest of terms. And the false church at the very end of the age, after the removal of the true church, has a brief time in world history of being prominent once again, in league with the revived Roman Empire. And it's a religious system. You might want to go look at Ray's comments on Mystery Babylon the Great. And it isn't just the Catholic Church, but it has the elements of Roman Catholic Church. It has the apostate elements from all branches of Christianity into this great world church, in league with the state, a church in league with the state. All the things that go wrong in religion are in this big church. It shouldn't last very long. The second part of Babylon in chapter 18 is commercial Babylon, so-called commercial Babylon. And she is pictured as being destroyed and eruptions of fire, maybe volcanoes or something, but so that the merchantmen and the traders and the men of commerce weep and lament over the destruction of this great city, which is, on the one hand, it's like Rome, but it's clear that this is God's judgment on all of civilization, on the commercial, legal, governmental aspects of our world that have been always contrary to the ways of God. We think our democratic way of life is the superior form of life, that it's fair, that our capitalistic system is really great. Well, it is in some ways, but in other ways it's not. It really is not the way God would have things run. And eventually it comes to the place where God judges man's religious system, and he judges the way we do business and our relationships with one another, and particularly this root of selfish ambition that's in mankind. It comes under the title of Mystery Babylon the Great. So it appears that at the end of the age there comes this judgment of God on this, the corruption that started with Babylon. That doesn't mean that the city of literal Babylon is out of the picture altogether, because it isn't, because literal Babylon still has to be destroyed. Literal Iraq still has to get eradicated. I don't know that we can figure out how that's going to happen. Seems to be in the Bible, sometime around the Battle of Armageddon, something bad happens to Iraq that makes it uninhabitable forever over there. You can think of nuclear weapons or chemical weapons or something like that. And I don't think that current war probably has much to do with that final ultimate judgment. When the world gets all flared up like it does right now, then everybody wants to run out and try to force-fit prophecy into what's going on. I don't think you can do that. Do the Hal Lindsey thing all over again. You do that once, but not every 5 years. Anyhow, the whole subject of Mystery Babylon the Great, if you find anything good on this, by all means, let me know or come and tell us about it. It's, as I mentioned, Hyslop is about the only book that's ever been written on this, and it's old, and it's pretty easy to criticize that book. I got a whole bunch of books on Babylon to see what the secular writers talk about the history of ancient Babylon and the gods of Babylon, and you won't find a hint of this in any of the secular books. So that means that I'm totally crazy and the Bible isn't relevant, and the history of Babylon didn't happen at all. There's nothing here in the Bible that fits. Well, I don't agree with that exactly. But on the other hand, I don't want to be too strongly opinionated when we don't. It would be nice if we had a lot of backup from secular history that lockstepped in with this, but that isn't the case right now. Yeah. Did you have your hand up, Doctor? Oh, no. Yeah. Islam is a offshoot of Judaism and Christianity. So it's a monotheistic religion, and its roots go back to Abraham. So it's not as ancient. It's not an ancient religion. What, 600 and something A.D.? It's recent. Mystery Babylon the Great appears to be an apostate church. It appears to be the apostate branch. The greatest blame is going to be laid on those people who had the truth. Most clearly, that'd be us. We're held more accountable than people who knew less about God. The conflict in Iraq right now doesn't have a lot to do with Islam as such, I don't think, because the Sunnis and the Shiites and the Kurds don't get along with each other very well. It's not a very unified country ethnically. Saddam would say he's a nominal Muslim, but he's certainly not a practicing Muslim. And the problem seems more to be his own evil, selfish ambition more than any other thing, and his wanting to control the whole area. He would love to make a new Babylon and take over the whole region and be the new Nimrod, but that's driven by his pride and his ambition. The judgment against apostate religion is universal. But but somehow in the Book of Revelation it centers in Rome, centers in the Christian churches more. A very severe judgment is due on Israel because Israel was entrusted originally with the Bible and with the truth. So the Jews are more accountable than the Arabs are, ultimately before God, because they were given the responsibility of disseminating the accurate knowledge of the one true God to the whole world, and the Messiah came from there, and they put him to death, and that's not very cool. And when Christ comes back, he himself has to deal with his own people with enormous bloodshed. Nobody gets off the hook, but so there's a great share of blame on Israel and a great deal of blame on the false elements in the Christian church. I don't know what happens to the Muslims. I don't see them as a huge major force at the end of the age necessarily. Maybe they are, but the feuds that are in the Middle East have an awful lot to do with Abraham and his two sons to this day. Get these tribal feuds that go on between these branches of the human family that don't get along well and have it for 4,000 years. So maybe we can save for next week the rest of this chapter and see what kind of questions you might have on this. Yeah.
I have mm-hmm.
Oh, dear. One is enough. Okay.
I've done geophysical crews coming out of the mm-hmm. If you take the time of the flood to the Tower of Babel, you say maybe only 3 or 4 hundred years
yep.
by,
mm-hmm.
we already have the formation of petroleum.
Mm-hmm.
The coming out of the ground.
Yeah.
For a long time, it was thought that petroleum took a long, long time
mm-hmm.
to actually generate the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And more recent studies,
Yeah.
And it becomes a volcano.
Mm-hmm. Heat and temperature and pressure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. With a very, very large amount of oil along that whole rift zone. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the oil well deposits do happen to come along the rift zones pretty much. And Thomas Gold's theory of the origin of gold was that of oil was that it was entrained methane entrained in the process of the formation of the earth. So he thinks that not all of the oil is biomass. He thinks that a lot of the oil is of primeval origin from trapped methane way inside the core. But the oil fields tend to be along these rift zones. Yeah. Exploited and used up. There are tar seeps to this very day in Iraq. Tar seeps in Southern California. I don't know if you've ever been to the La Brea tar pits. And off Long Beach there are tar. And La Brea, there's an interesting article on the La Brea tar pits that I just read last week about the fact that there's a considerable controversy about how the animals were entrapped. The usual idea was, the theory was that animals wandered out under this, what looked like lakes of water and it was an inch of water and 30 feet of tar. But that's questioned now. And so there's an awful lot of fossils. The La Brea tar pits have been excavated way down, and all kinds of saber-toothed tigers and wonderful beasts are in the museum. You ought to go down there if you get down to the Los Angeles Center and go visit that nice museum. The fossils coming out of that tar pit are tremendous. Chris? No, I don't think so. Not that I know of. Hydrocarbons, there's plenty of. I don't know. You can research that for us and tell us. Yes, sir. Oh, that's a great question. We don't know what Adam looked like, do we? We don't know what Noah looked like. All of us in here carry the genes of Noah and his wife. We don't know what the wives looked like at all. I don't know about genetics very much, but I've been told that you get maximum variation when the breeding population is small. If you have a small breeding population, then you get the greatest variation in offspring right away. You get the greatest diversification in the first generation or two. So you begin to get dark-skinned people going right away in the line of Ham, and you begin to get light, fair-skinned people in the line of Japheth right away. And that's all apart from intermarriage. And if somebody knows about genetics and can give us a little summary of this, but the human genome must have been so complicated that all this variety in this room today was built into Adam. It's all been passed on down to us. But when you take a branch of when you split the branches of the family off, then you'll get local diversity in genetic characteristics. Yeah. Well, I think they had in the Law of Moses later on one of the prohibitions of the Law of Moses was not to be drawn astray to worship the host of heaven, which would be the angelic host. One of the beliefs about the Tower of Babel was that this was the sanctuary for calling down the hosts of heaven, for essentially the worship of angels, which gets you into demonic occultic power right away. So if the Tower of Babel was an occultic center where you actually invoked the gods of heaven, which would be demonic gods, and the astrology, our astrology in the world today is Babylonian. The kind of astrology that we have today in the morning newspaper comes from Babylon. So there's this strong occult element in the religion of ancient Babylon. There may have been an original uncorrupted Hebrew astrology, but the astrology that you get now is Babylonian, comes from Babylon.
Well, Stephen's up there.
Yeah.
And they named them after this star constellation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
The period of rotation of this axis is 26,000
years. That's true. Remember that when you get to the Greeks and Romans, then the planets all have gods associated with them. Mars, the god of war, and Venus, the goddess of love. Mars is Marduk, by the way. Same root source. Mars, the god of war, is Tide is associated directly with Marduk. The Egyptian religion seems to have been worship, not only the worship of the sun, but the worship of the pharaoh as the incarnation of the sun god Ra. So this worship of sun, moon, and stars, the worship of the host of heavens, that's in Romans 1. When you stop worshiping the one true God, God gives you up to worship that which was created instead of the creator. We're religious. We can't help but being religious. And if you aren't worshiping the right God, then in come all the counterfeits. Yes, ma'am. Remember that when we, back in Genesis 6, when we talked about the Nephilim, the giants, there was a very brief mention that there were giants after the flood. And that raises the question of how they got there. They weren't on board the ark. Were there faulty, damaged genes in Noah and his children that later on would give rise to the giants, maybe out of the Canaanite peoples? Was there a second invasion of evil angels into the human race? I don't know. We know that when you get to the time of when Joshua's day, when Joshua came into the land, there were giants living there. And Goliath was one of these. Extra fingers and toes and very tall. And there's mention of these giants around Hebron and up in the Golan Heights dying out. There are several mentions in the Bible for this second race, the Rephaim and the Anakim. But there's almost nothing we know about them, really. Other than that they're genetically deformed and large and very cruel, violently cruel. I don't know. See? Oh, yes, sir. Mm-hmm. This is, of course, kind of like Francis Schaeffer's lifelong problem was how do you reach modern man with the truth? What are the mythologies that govern the people in the world today who do not believe in Jesus? What's the secular mythology of the day? There's the myth of the progress of mankind. Okay, you can be your own God. You can make whatever you want out of your life. Yes, you've got whatever you want. That's an old lie, the lie of the garden. You can be your own God. What else? Man is basically good. That's a great one. Or at least you think it does. Huh? Well, I think that mythologies become more subtle every generation because we are not running after stone gods anymore. We don't get on. If you go to India and parts of the world, they really do have stone gods and idols and Buddhas and things. And the Greeks and Romans had gods. We remember all the nice things Glenn Miller's told us about the deities of the ancients, the Egyptians, the superstitions. I thought that when Glenn Miller talked about this, very, very helpful for us to see how people in the Roman Empire thought about themselves and the gods, local gods, and the favor of the gods in war. And behind those deities of the world are demons. And with superstition, people actually, there are real demons out there that people are giving their allegiance to. But we get so sophisticated that we think we're not idolatrous, but in fact, we're just very clever at it.
Well, we have Porsches.
We do have Porsches, yeah. Yes, ma'am. Well, we talked about I speculated that the Earth's axis had probably tilted a little bit. 20 degrees maybe sometime early on, maybe at the time of the flood. And there's this evidence of George Dodwell, the Australian astronomer, that the Earth tilted back to its present axis in 2, 3, 4, 5 BC. You can find that from ancient Egyptian records probably. Not a major flip over, but a tilt. So I think there have been catastrophes and upheavals down through history and asteroids hitting and things like that. Yes. Well, how would you put that if you were a CEO at a big corporation here and you've got vast resources and unlimited talent and you're making a speech to the stockholders, what would you say? We can do anything, yeah. We can do. We've got the manpower, we've got the money, we've got the brains, we've got the experience. We are going to... Yeah. And this pride, this root of pride in there that makes you think you can be your own God, that you're not actually weak and helpless. And then also this a selfish society like this lacks community. It lacks really loving, caring, brotherly, sisterly concern for one another. And then with that goes all the loneliness of people being isolated from one another, being competitive, and everybody's rivals. So we've got it in Silicon Valley, I think. Well, next time we'll look a little bit. In the rest of chapter 11, we can get all the way down to Abraham. And then if you want to go all the way down from Abraham, you can go all the way down to Jesus. So I think we've got a pretty good bloodline, all of us back to Adam. And our connection to Jesus is by faith. We're his sons by faith in Jesus. And then we become Abraham's children. But we'll carry on. And please take a 3x5 card and give me questions.